Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Lemisa Abdelalti from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Today, I'll be talking to Marcus Bell about his book, Outsiders, Memories of Migration to and from North Korea. This book was published by Berghahn Books in 2022. The book offers an in-depth look at how individuals and families on the move remake themselves and also transform the places they go to. It argues that migration is a survival strategy, not just for migrants, but for the societies they settle in as well. Marcus, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Fantastic. So I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us just a bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure, of course. So I'm currently working as a consultant to the UN International Organization for Migration, working to both the Myanmar missions and the Cambodia mission. And I'm also a research fellow to La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, to the Department of Politics, Media and Philosophy. And so I've been working in these positions for a couple of years, but prior to that I was assistant professor at the University of Sheffield in England, in the north of England, very proud there. And this had me teaching anthropology and Korean studies as well.
Well, I'm very excited to have you here to talk about your fantastic book. So how did you come to write this book, Outsiders?
Great question. Well, I think as a lot of academics, I think the interest started with an interest. I wanted to know more about myself. And we're solipsistic. And especially as anthropologists, we have these questions about people, and the people we often know the best are ourselves. So I'll admit, my interest started about as a kid in movement and migration, because I was brought up in a military family. I was moving every 2 or 3 years in Europe and in Asia, and it became very normal for me to keep moving. And then when I was living in East Asia as an adult in Korea and Japan, it was I started to think more about this positioning or this positionality as a foreigner, being a foreigner, being on the outside of things, and how, what kind of lens this offers for seeing the world in a distinct way. And it was this way of seeing the world or the world that I wanted to start to understand better. So that's kind of the broad background, but more specifically, while I was studying my master's degree in Seoul, South Korea, I was volunteering at an NGO called the Rainbow Foundation, and I was it was teaching English. And I was going around the class saying, "Okay, today we're going to talk about where you're from. I'm from New Zealand. We're famous for sheep. Where are you from?" And the answers. So the first young lady said, "Oh, I'm from North Korea. I'm from Shinmiju." Oh, goodness me. Oh, wow. Okay, great. Yeah, okay. And next person said, "I'm from North Korea too. I'm from Hamhung." Wow. All right. And so it went around the circle. Each person turned out they're from North Korea. And here we were talking about sheep in New Zealand and then North Korea with this group of fascinating young men and women. And over time, I became quite good friends with a couple of them. And we were sitting around one day eating pizza, and as you do, and they said, you know, Marcus, for your master's thesis, you should write about us. Write about our story. People need to know about North Koreans. And so that's how it started. My interest in North Koreans in exile specifically, that's how that started. I was involved in various NGOs throughout that time. And then after I finished my master's, I really needed a fresh start. I'd been in South Korea for 6 years by then. I needed to clear my mind. And I heard from friends in Japan that there were around 300 North Korean exiles living in Japan. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. This is a challenge, because from what I'd heard, these people were not just North Koreans in exile. They had gone to North Korea. They had chosen to go to North Korea, and then they'd come back. But this is absolutely fascinating. And so I went to Japan. At the time, I spoke Japan, Japanese rather poorly. And I met a couple of people. Basically, it's a snowball kind of methodology. But it went from there. And then a few years later, we get the book.
And the result is really just an incredible set of reflections on, you know, mobility, identity, belonging, memory, and all sorts of other really fascinating aspects. So you started to talk a little bit about sort of the population of interest in this book. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us just a little bit more about, you know, who are the sorts of people about whom this book is sort of focusing on?
Right. So broadly speaking, these are people who in the 1960s and 1970s, these are Koreans who were living in Japan. And they were originally, many of them were brought to Japan, or they went to Japan as part of the Japanese colonial workforce. So they were in Japan. And then in the 1960s and 1970s, they went to North Korea. They went to North Korea because of the various push and pull dynamics. But they went to North Korea because they wanted a better life. And they thought North Korea looks like somewhere where we can have a better life. And then fast forward a few decades, in the last 15 or so years, some 300, approximately 300, have come back to Japan going via China. And they have had to restart their lives several decades later. So the book is focused on these men and women and some children who have made these multiple migrations throughout East Asia. Sometimes by choice, sometimes they were compelled to by those macro forces. And I wanted to know really what how these kinds of multiple migrations shapes and reshapes a person, and then of course how people who move how they impact and shape the societies to which they move.
Wonderful. And I'm hoping we can dive into some of these stories in detail. But let me ask you first, what sort of research did you do for this book? You know, what types of approaches methodologically did you employ here?
A lot of luck. I think luck was a key driving force. I initially went to South Korea for 3 months. And when I was in South Korea, this was in 2013, 14. I got in contact with my North Korean friends from the time I was previously there, and I talked to them about these people I'd heard about. Did you know anyone from Japan? And that, we knew some people from Japan, and they were pretty much just like us, but they had nicer clothes, or they had different smells coming from their kitchens because their grandmothers and mothers were cooking strange foods. Okay, this is very interesting. So, all right. So after a few months in Seoul, went to Osaka in Japan. And I knew it wasn't going to be easy to try and track down 300 people. in Japan. So I located, with the help of a dear friend and colleague in Japan, I located a couple of gatekeepers, and I spoke with them. One is an academic and another is a journalist. And the journalist said to me, yes, I know some of these returnees from North Korea, and I would happily introduce you to them, but perhaps you could do some volunteer work for my journalist outfit in the meantime. I said, okay, great, yeah, that'd be good. So I started working for this journalist outfit. I was volunteering there. They gave me a desk, which was more than a lot of grad students have. And I was translating and editing reports coming out of North Korea from undercover reporters there. So we, this outfit runs undercover reporters. And so it was absolutely fascinating, if a bit harrowing at times, to have this kind of direct contact. And so over time, the director of this journalist outfit introduced me to some returnees, and I met more through some other organizations. And what I tried not to do, I didn't ask for an interview. I didn't ask for, I didn't even ask for, tell me about your story, because I'm trying to be a good anthropologist, all those things we learn as undergrads and build rapport. But and it was great. But what I also found is that a lot of these individuals, they wanted to tell their story. So we'd go out for a barbecue, a Korean barbecue in Osaka, or we'd go and get coffee in Shibuya in Tokyo, and we'd just be I'd be talking about my difficulties living in South Korea and how I did my best to study Korean, but I always felt like I didn't belong, or in Japan where the similar kind of things, and they would say, "Yeah, that's exactly how I feel now. That's exactly how it is. Even in North Korea, I was born there, but I always felt it didn't quite click with me, and that's why I came back." So after a while, I had interviews with several people, and it snowballed, and it took a lot of time, but I felt it was worth it. To use some more cold language, I felt the quality of the data, it was a high quality data. I don't like saying those kind of things. But and after it got to the point where I felt that I had spent enough time in Japan, funds were running low, and I felt like I needed more to undergird the oral histories and the interviews. So I went to Geneva in Switzerland. And again, thanks to another friend for letting me stay at his place for several months. Geneva is a very expensive place. So I went to Geneva in Switzerland and I became a mole person. I moved into the basement of the International Red Cross archives and I didn't see light for a long time. But it meant that I had access to now declassified files about the repatriation movement. Of course, this book is about repatriation movement, which is the mass movement of 93,000 people from Japan to North Korea. So I had all this data, these archival documents from the North Korean government, from the Japanese government, from the Red Cross. And I could see, I could triangulate what my learnings from Japan and from South Korea, and see, okay, so this interviewee said that she went to North Korea aboard this boat, and she described the boat and blah blah blah, and then I could see the boat, the ship being written about in the archival documents. I thought, oh, this is glorious, this is fantastic. I never, it was just things clicked. Lucky, so lucky. And then I came away with a lot of documents photographed over several months, and the writing began.
And you put it together in the book really so well. So diving in, you begin the book by sort of describing conditions in post-World War II Japan and the movements that took place to North Korea. And here you're especially interested in comparing official history with what you call vernacular memories. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, right. So Vernacular memories is, I use this term to describe the personal histories, the kind of histories that exist within often sub-communities or minority communities or within families. So these are, it might be as simple as every family has a "we were almost rich" story about Uncle So-and-so who owned a big factory and then he blew it all at the gambling table. So it's things like, these are very personal histories. And so these vernacular memories in this case, they are memories of life in Japan. Life in Japan as a Korean minority. In life in Japan in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And remember, Japan hasn't always been the wealthy, high-tech place that it is today. And so back in the 1940s, during the Second World War, Koreans were often working in very difficult, dangerous, and dirty jobs in factories, in mines, in very demanding spaces. And so they were working in these areas, and life was very difficult for them. But then the war ends and everyone goes, hurrah, hooray. The problem is that in Japan, of course, Japan was a defeated nation, and the Japanese were far from happy about being defeated. And the Koreans there, who initially thought, yay, now we're liberated, we're under the Japanese yoke, they said, okay, but now what happens? Some of them had been born in Japan, some of them had been Japanese. Japan was home, and they had to figure out what happened in their lives next. And what they found very quickly is that they were not Japanese. They were not regarded as Japanese. They were outsiders in a place where, in some cases, they'd lived their entire lives. While many went back to Japan, 650,000 Koreans stayed. While many went back to Korea, around 650,000 stayed in Japan. And it's their memories, their intimate memories, their vernacular memories of life during this time, of being pushed to the margins, of not being able to rent in certain areas, of not being able to find jobs in certain positions because they were Koreans, even though they could speak Japanese perfectly, you know, in every way, blah, 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 not being able to marry in Japan a Japanese family because they weren't permitted to protect the purity of the bloodline. So it's these micro memories, these vernacular memories, which come up against, they clash against the Japanese official memories of the memories of the majority society. Now, official memories, these are things which we don't even consider them as memories. These are things like, I think I give the example in the book of George Washington crossing the Delaware, how this is this act has become enshrined in American folklore. It's in every American book, and it's an official memory. It's something which is used alongside the Stars and Stripes and the national anthem. These are symbols of what it is to be an American. I realize here I'm talking to an American, so please tell me if I've got any of that wrong. In a similar, I use the example from Australia and New Zealand as well with the Anzacs. These were soldiers who fought in the First World War, and the Anzac has become a foundational myth, just as the crossing of the Delaware and the War of Independence has become founding myth of our societies. So these are official memories. And when you have these vernacular memories coming in and saying, actually, some of what you're talking about isn't quite right. In fact, in our community, we didn't experience the benefits of freedom, if you want to use that word, or we didn't experience the benefits of the economic boom. In fact, we couldn't get jobs because we were Korean in Osaka, or we weren't allowed to rent in this area of Sydney because we are indigenous people. So you have these clash of these minority community and the stories that they tell themselves and their histories with the dominant society's founding myths and their official histories. And that's what I use to describe what's happening with the return of people from North Korea and their experiences of post-war Japan. I hope that makes sense.
Right. And you show how, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but you show how it is that sort of the official narrative in Japan that this was a humanitarian mission to repatriate Koreans who voluntarily wanted to return to North Korea is sort of at odds with some of these vernacular memories, as you put it, of, you know, actual Koreans describing the hardship and the persecution and the discrimination that their families encountered in Japan, and the ways in which they sort of got caught up in geostrategic considerations as well involving Japan and the Koreas that led to sort of this push to return them, right, to the Koreas. Not actually return them to North Korea, because as you know, most of them, their families are actually from South Korea, right, and they wind up going to North Korea. But the book then goes on to talk about various strategies that people use. You know, these families that are moving between Japan and the Koreas across generations. And one of the strategies that they use, that you describe, is they use marriage to build alliances. Can you describe that process for us?
Right. So, yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. What I noticed early on when I was talking to the returnees from North Korea is that they could often describe their family background going all the way back to the at least to Japan, their first moments in Japan, if not back to an island off the south of the Korean Peninsula called Jeju Island. And one of the commonalities in across the stories was that, we always made sure we had a matchmaker from Jeju Island so that we could marry another Jeju Islander, because, you know, we wouldn't want to marry someone from a different province. Oh, goodness, no. Oh, goodness. Okay, that's interesting, I thought to myself. All right, very interesting. And then, so they're marrying not just other Koreans in Japan, but they're seeking out people from the same island, if not the same part of the island. All right, then they go to North Korea, and similar kinds of things are happening to the Koreans who go to North Korea. They are employing matchmakers from who've been on the boat with them and from Japan, and if possible, who can also come from Jeju, who are setting them up with someone from maybe in another town or village living in North Korea, but who has the same background, same migratory background, so they've made similar journeys, but then the same ethnic background, but then the same kinship background in that they come from a similar in the same village or the same town or the same area of the island. And similar things are happening also with the returnees to Osaka and Tokyo. So returnees, they recognize that they have a common language. They recognize that they have a common background and a common way of seeing the world. You know, we all do this, even unconsciously. And so now returnees, also several of them, I spoke with, they marry each other as well. Again, they don't, well, in this case, they don't necessarily need matchmakers because there are so few of them in Japan. It's usually through the nascent returnee networks. But this kind of intermarriage, it has its advantages because you have things in common with that, not just the person you're marrying, but also your family is more likely, the idea is, to get on with their family. Great. The problem, of course, is that, or what they found out, is that it exacerbates an already existent distance between these new arrivals and the host society. So instead of marrying a local and then sort of bridging that gap, and maybe your children will be able to speak, I don't know, Korean or Japanese better, that doesn't happen. So they're marrying within their group, and they're not, I guess you'd say, integrating. They're not integrating into the broader society.
Another strategy that you describe is what you call identity management. So I wanted to ask you, you know, and maybe you could give us specific examples, you know, if you're able. But, you know, how did some of your interlocutors sort of manage their identities to try to survive in North Korea, having, you know, moved from Japan to North Korea?
Right. Yeah. So a lot of these people who went to North Korea, of these 93,340 people who went to North Korea, many of them were optimistic that they would have a better life there. They were offered free education, free healthcare, free housing, opportunities to study in Pyongyang, or if not Pyongyang, you know, maybe you could even go and study in Moscow if you were exceptional. And at the same time, they had these push factors. The Japanese government didn't want Koreans there anymore, and so they were pushing them to leave. And they got there, and they found very quickly that they were considered little different to Japanese. And this was a stark realization to people who had, in many cases, regarded themselves as staunch Korean patriots. They believed in the message of Kim Il-sung. They believed in the message of a Korean, for Koreans, built by Koreans. And you remember the Korean War, 1950 to 1953, North Korea was still recovering from it, but it was doing far better economically than South Korea and continued to do so until the late 60s, early 70s. And then they got there, and the locals look at them and say, you dress like Japanese, you barely speak Korean, you walk like a Japanese person. What's the difference here? And so they immediately felt these frictions. Now for a while, for the families who had still had strong connections to family and friends in Japan, they were able to leverage the goods and money sent to them from Japan to develop networks in North Korea, to bribe cadres, to basically survive some of the harder times. There had been sporadic food shortages in North Korea throughout its existence, and create a kind of buffer against these threats to their families, to their communities. But for many people, they didn't have the luxury of having this money and goods sent to them, which they could sell or buy things with. And they found that they had to be very, very careful in how they presented their outside face, if you want to call it their face, their outside identity. And so I talk about identity management in the way that many of these families very quickly realize if they speak Japanese in public, if they act Japanese in public, if they say the wrong thing about Kim Il-sung, the leader of North Korea at that time, they would be punished for it. And it started when they first, some of the younger ones, there are a couple of interviewees who described being in high school and they didn't know how to speak Korean. But they knew very quickly they learned swear words because the North Korean students around them would call them terrible things. And so they learned very quickly, these are the bad words. Okay. And then they learned if they speak Japanese in class, if they're right in Japanese, they will be punished, physically punished in class. So though they started early on, and then when they got older, one interview in particular told me, it was good we learned this when we were young, because when we were adults, And she held her wrists together. She told me this to show me as if the wrists had been bound, and she was indicating that they would have been very severely punished. I digress. But the point is that they learned very quickly that outside they would act Korean, they would speak Korean, they would wear when possible, they would wear the appropriate clothes, they would go to the to the sessions where they would have to self-criticize and they would do it with great gusto. But then inside the home, inside these most intimate of spaces, they could cook some of the Japanese food products that were sent to them. They could speak Japanese. And one interviewee recalled to me a time that there were many blackouts, never enough power. And during those blackouts, Dad would get out the guitar and he'd sing Japanese songs to us. Now, very quietly, mind, very quietly. There wasn't going to be a big party in Japanese. But these were the ways that outside, act Korean, inside, you can feel more comfortable. And this was when returnees to North Korea would meet each other, they would they'd say, okay, what's your name? What ship did you arrive on? Where are you from in Japan? And this would be a way of identifying, okay, this is a trusted person, and this is someone who maybe has been here longer than me. They can teach me things about North Korean society. But this is how they managed to survive. And I describe it as not just a way of acting, but a form of what James Scott referred to as weapons of the weak. So a form of resisting those broader oppressive dynamics that were being channeled towards them by the government, by the state, to try and erase, to try and stomp out any of their, hybrid Japanese characteristics. And so this kind of resistance, it wasn't about protesting or anything like that, because you can't do that in North Korea, but it was about writing letters to family back home and letting them know how you were doing through coded messages. It was about cooking and consuming Japanese foods. And what I argue is that these ways of acting, what happened is that these people, these families, they ended up feeling quite connected to communities and families back in Japan. Now, so what I argue is that these ordinary practices contributed to the careful management and then transmission of a group characteristic to the next generation. And this was not an ethno-nationalist or revolutionary socialist identity. It was a trans-local identity that connected these families not to back to Japan as a country, but back to localities in Japan, back to the communities that they left. So that's why these kind of identity management, this identity management strategy is particularly important beyond the phenomenon itself.
Now, so you document sort of the decision-making process whereby people whose families originally moved from Japan to North Korea then decide to leave North Korea, right? There's a little bit of a puzzle here, right? Why do people who are leaving North Korea decide to go to Japan rather than going to South Korea, where they would receive state benefits and where there would seem to be closer cultural and linguistic ties? So exactly. Why is it that people choose Japan?
Yeah, exactly. So this was something I needed to know, because having previously carried out research in South Korea, I know that the South Korean government provides a very generous resettlement package for people from North Korea. The Japanese government does not, for reasons you can understand. But these people were choosing to come to Japan. Why were they doing it? Well, there was one particular interviewee, named Son Dong-hyun, and he explained to me, I actually did the maths, I did the calculations, and I worked out, okay, the resettlement package in South Korea will get me this much money. Great. And the social welfare, which I'll be on in Japan, will support me this way. And he said, actually, they weren't too different, but what I'd heard about is that North Koreans who go to South Korea, they start dead at the bottom and they're subject to a lot of prejudice. They're considered like the country bumpkin cousins and a tax drain on South Korean coffers. Now, I thought about going back to Japan, and I thought about the friends I used to have. I thought about the places I used to hang out. I thought, actually, I still speak pretty good Japanese. I left, in this case, I think he left when he was 10 or 11 or something. And he based his decision not on the simply the financial aspects and the opportunities that he and his children might have got in South Korea with preferential access to universities and things like that, but on the emotional ties which had connected him, continued to connect him over 3 or 4 decades of living in North Korea, those emotional ties back to communities in Japan. And I found this particularly interesting because it challenges what is regarded as well understood and accepted ideas about what drives migrants to go places: economics. Everyone goes from here to there because they can make more money. It's more complicated than that. And so the various examples I give show the other factors involved, and they are emotional drivers, and decisions are made within the family about what matters and what doesn't matter. How do we keep you safe? It's not just about how do we make more money. that's really what I'm talking about when I talk about emotionally directed mobility. And I think Donghyun's example, I found it particularly compelling. I've got a couple of others in there too.
So there's also a fascinating discussion that you go into about how changing labor and gender relations have shaped returnees' experiences in Japan. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, absolutely. In the early 1990s, the North Korean economy collapsed, and this was due to the end of the Soviet Union, and Soviet Union was the primary benefactor of North Korea, and then a series of floods and other terrible environmental disasters struck the country. The North Korean government was not prepared in any way, and so they basically said to the people, it's up to you. You will have to endure this in the same way that Kim Il-sung endured his the hardships of fighting the Japanese imperialists during during the 1930s. Okay, so what happened is, interestingly, because although the economy had collapsed, the men in particular still had to go to work. They still had to go to the factory. They still had to go to the office. They still had to go to the field, because that's what men do, and they were expected to be present. Women, however, although North Korea considered itself to be a women's paradise, women, they work, and then they're the traditional role in North Korea as a child-raising role. And while looking after children and doing all these other things, they were also doing things like brewing rice wine, making tofu, making rice snacks, things like that. And what happened is that this household economy shifted outside to black markets. And so gradually it was women who were making these products and then making the money which came into the house and to trading in the barter system to support the families and support the broader North Korean economy. And so in the early mid 1990s, North Korean women became absolutely essential for keeping the families and the state afloat. They were trading homemade products. They were trading from China. They were the grinders. They were making things happen. And what I argue in the book is that there have been echoes of this gendered flip in gender roles that took place in North Korea. There've been echoes of these changes in the North Korean diaspora. So, of course, I'm looking at Japan in this case. And through my ethnographic work in Osaka and Tokyo and through my interviews, I found that it seemed to me that women were more willing, for example, to look for help from Japanese NGOs, to accept help, to do jobs which they were probably way too skilled for, way too, they but they were willing to do those jobs so that they could have a hope of accessing upward socioeconomic mobility, so that they could have a hope to learn Japanese quickly, so that they could hope to move out of the sleeping on the floor of the factory in Osaka to moving into their own apartment. And these were women who had previously been working in markets in North Korea, supporting their families. Now, in contrast, some of the men I worked with seemed almost trapped by their understandings of what masculinity is. So they couldn't ask for help, they couldn't accept help, and they couldn't take jobs which they considered were beneath them, even if it meant that they weren't able to source an income stream that would support their family. They certainly couldn't go to a Japanese language school where they would be surrounded by women learning Japanese. That's obviously not my voice. That's the voice of an interviewee. And so what happens is that many of the women I worked with, the women returnees from North Korea, they were speaking fluent Japanese. They were opening businesses at the markets. They were doing things which you just think, wow, impressive. Like this is hustling. This is awesome. In contrast, some of the men I worked with seemed to not have really improved the situation at all since the arrival in Japan, because of what they regarded as a man's role, a man's job. Now, of course, this is a rough rendering. I explain it in more detail in the book. But I found this fascinating because I could trace it back to the early and mid-1990s when it was women who supported North Korea in some of its darkest times.
Now, in the book, you document how it is that in Japan, there are a number of civic organizations that attempt to assist returnees from North Korea. How would you characterize the relationship between returnees and these activists in Japan?
Yeah, so I should just start by saying that many of these organizations are absolutely crucial. They do incredible work supporting returnees from North Korea. They do things like find them accommodation if they arrive. When returnees arrive in Japan, they have nothing. They often don't speak Japanese. They have no money. They're starting often starting from scratch. They might have some family. They might have some friends. So they find them accommodation if they don't have any. They help source some jobs if they don't have a job. They direct them towards local Japanese language schools if they don't speak Japanese, which many of them don't. So they do crucial work. And what happens is that I argue that what happens is that these returnees who take these gifts from them feel an immense weight of obligation. And so I'm drawing on Mauss here, and I'm drawing on various anthropological ideas of gift giving and how it creates relationships, but also how it can threaten to destroy relationships. And so they accept these, and they arrive in Japan, they accept these great things, and they can start their lives, but they feel like they have to give something back to the activists. So they go to activist meetings or NGO meetings, and many of these men are the same who run these organizations. They're very anti North Korea. They want to see the end of the regime in North Korea, and these returnees from North Korea, they say, okay, can you come to the meeting and can you tell us about your hard life in North Korea? Or can you provide a testimony for our website where you explain how we rescued you or how we supported you? Okay. Now, the problem is there that they, in joining with these activists, these NGOs, and their past, their lives in North Korea are required to be almost weaponized by these groups and used as evidence of that North Korea is hell on earth. And they have to, they feel like they need to keep doing this. Why do they need to keep supporting these groups? Why do they need to keep attending these meetings? Why do they need, because they can, you can never repay such a heavy debt. The gift of freedom, the gift of freedom from North Korea is something which all the testimonials, all the help that you could provide these groups with will never be enough. And so it's an incredible burden, but and it threatens not just their sense of security, but also their family back in North Korea. How does it do this? Because if you're standing on a stage and you're writing about how horrible my life is in North Korea and how the Kim regime are tyrants and terrible, they are terrible, but and you're writing about these things and you still have family in North Korea, they are threatened. They are, you are making it possible that you will be identified and that your family will be identified, and it will, could cause them severe problems in North Korea. So I talk about the gift in this chapter because I talk about the exchange that takes place, and it's an unequal relationship, and it's a heavy gift that they take that can never be repaid. They try and repay it through their stories, through their engagement with these NGOs, but they never can. And the problem is one of choice. Returnees working with Japanese civic groups, they don't feel that they can refuse to help, even if their participation in high-profile attacks on North Korea risks their own life. So I try and unpack this relationship, and I see it as, for all the incredible good that these groups do, it has its problematic aspects too.
So my final question about the book is you have a really insightful chapter on mobility and memory. Can I ask you to describe what you call, quote, the strategic use of remembering and forgetting, end quote?
Yeah, sure. So in this chapter, I talk about three returnees from North Korea now living in Osaka. And one of them is called Sungmi. And I accompanied Sungmi on a journey to try and find her hometown. Now, Sungmi left Japan in the 1960s. I think she was 13, 14 years old, something like that. And since she came back to Japan, she'd been there around she'd been there about a year at that time. She had felt like she couldn't connect to anything, nothing at all. And without that connection, without being able to remember herself in Japan at that time, it was extremely difficult for her to ever believe that this could have once have been home, that this was the right place for her. So we went on this long train journey out to the countryside, and at the end of the line, it was a really hot day. We walked up and down the hills looking for her old house. Now, in the early 1960s Japan, in this particular village, the houses were made of wood. It was old style Japanese living. And so we assumed it had just been, you know, we couldn't find it. And then we decided, let's ask a local. And so we asked a local, do you remember any Korean families living here 50 years ago? And she said, oh, she sort of, you know, scratched her chin and gazed into the distance. She said, actually, yes, I remember some Korean families. All the kids used to run around the hill over there, and there was an old Korean man who used to smoke a pipe. But they all went to North Korea. They all went. And so he said, yeah, that was us. That was me. That was us. And so they started speaking quite fast, and it's difficult to keep up. But what they were doing is they were exchanging memories about what life was like in that village at that time. And you could, at the end of the conversation, you could see the life that had been breathed into Sungmi's face. She looked like a different person. And the old lady took her by the arm, and we walked across the road to this parking lot. And she said, pointing at the parking lot, she said, you know, this is where your home was. And I thought to myself, oh no, goodness, this is rather depressing. But as we said our goodbyes and walked away, suddenly she had reconnected with the help of that woman and a collaboration of memory. She had reconnected to a time and a place which had almost been completely destroyed. Even if her home was now a car park, she had imagined it there. She could see it in front of her through her memories. And I found this incredibly, an incredibly compelling experience that demonstrated the power of memory in relocating someone and allowing them to feel a connectedness to a space and a time, which had, well, half a century earlier. So I think, yeah, that was the most, for me, the most interesting example of how some of these returnees find connectedness, build a relationship to the place that they left so long ago. But of course, there are returnees who were born in North Korea. So these are the children, the grandchildren of people who went from Japan to North Korea. And those returnees, they don't have their own memories of life in Japan. Instead, they have inherited memories of life in Japan. We talked about earlier at home singing songs in Japanese, telling Japanese folk stories and cooking Japanese food. Those actions fostered in this younger generation a connectedness back to Japan, but it also gave them memories. And so they came back to Japan with those inherited memories, and now they have to try and figure out how do these inherited memories fit, and how do I fit with Japan? How does it all come together? And so the example I give of this younger returnee called Mison, she has tried desperately to find a place for herself in Japan. She speaks beautiful Japanese. She wears Japanese clothes, does Japanese makeup. She works at a Japanese company. And she's done everything she can to pass, knowing that my parents are once here. My grandparents are once here. So I'm here too. But it never works because she makes a simple grammar mistake, grammatical error. Her accent slips a little bit. And suddenly it's the old question. Where are you really from? What is that? What did you just say? And so she feels like she failed in Japan. So she went to South Korea. Okay, so originally, my friend from South Korea, it'll work there. Unfortunately, a similar kind of thing. She said to the grandmothers in the market in Jeju Island, "I'm from here. This is my hometown." They say, "No, you're not. Your accent. You're not from here. You're a Zainichi, you're a Korean Japanese." So failure again. And so her story is one of not being able to identify one place, but I don't view that as a failure in the book. I view that as an opportunity and a new and interesting way of belonging, not just for Mison, but for other people that I worked with, other returnees from North Korea. Because so much of what we understand about nations and communities is based on sedentary existence. That is, staying in one place, being tied with your roots and your family history and all these kind of things, which are so important. But these people offered alternative forms of belonging. And Mison's example, where she feels like she failed in one place, failed in the other. Now, she came to a place in her life where she started to feel, maybe I am connected to everywhere. I have stories here. I have stories there and there. So I don't need to try and pretend to be Japanese. It's never going to work anyway. So I don't get fully there, but I try and articulate that nascent sense of acceptance about this is a different way of seeing myself and these places in the world.
Well, Marcus, I really wish we had more time to talk about the book. It's such an insightful look at sort of the interplay between dislocation and reinvention. As you say in the book, both for the migrants, but also for host societies. And I just want listeners to know that, you know, we've only sort of been able to really touch on some of the really powerful and moving stories that are in the book. And I should note that the book is also beautifully written. So listeners will really, really enjoy going through it if you pick it up. So Marcus, just one final question. You know, this book is done. And so, you know, we're wondering what is it that you're working on now?
Yeah, wow. The book is done. Exclamation mark. So I've shifted recently away from East Asia, and now I'm working on forced migration, human trafficking, and labor migration in Southeast Asia. So it's a bit of a sideways step, but I feel like I'm acting as more of a practitioner than I was before. I'm employing these skills and ideas that I was teaching in a very hands-on way, which is good for an anthropologist. I feel like that's what I should be doing. And it's keeping me busy. We'll see what comes out of it in the future in terms of books. But honestly, I think like a lot of people, the last couple of years has been a bit turbulent with the pandemic and then the coup in Myanmar. And it's changed the course of my research in ways I didn't anticipate. But yeah, I'm looking forward to what comes next. I'm enjoying what I'm doing now. If it means I can stay in one place for more than two or three years, I think that would be a blessing.
Well, I look forward to see what you produce next. I really enjoyed our conversation, Marcus. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you very much, Lenise. Appreciate it.
The book is Marcus Bell's Outsiders, Memories of Migration to and from North Korea, published by Berghahn Books in 2022. Thank you for listening.